What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. A little jazz throwback. My guest this next half hour, Milwaukee County Board Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. Tell everybody what we're listening to.
Beard by Eric Dolphy, who was considered one of the more offbeat jazz musicians of the 60s.
Yeah, it's got that 60s kind of vibe to it.
Most definitely. He had manic energy, not quite as manic as Coltrane, but, you know, both saxophone players, clarinetists, so.
Yeah. It's cool. It's got those, like, weird chords and that intonation that's you know, makes your brain kind of light up and go, what am I hearing? This is interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming back, Juan. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, too. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I reached out because following Cinco de Mayo, there was some violence in Mitchell Park, which is really sad to see. Love that space. Tell everybody what happened and what some of your thinking about how to make this better is.
Sure. Well, okay, so the violence happened outside of Mitchell Park, but, you know, there were incidents in Mitchell Park. I woke up on Monday to my Facebook and my Messenger and, like, text messages lighting up my phone saying, what are you going to do about this? Look at what happened. Look at this. And I found a video, and what it was some youth taking a paletero's cart. A paletero's like those men that, like, push around, like, the yep. popsicle carts. They took it from him and they ran a few feet and then knocked it over and then ran away. And all of a sudden it became this very racist kind of thing amongst the community where it turned into this black versus brown thing, which was really genuinely upsetting for me because, you know, we're all living in the same community. And I think it's very important that we all work together instead of hurting each other and trying to turn it into racist stereotypes when it turned out to be something that was the viciousness of youth, I guess.
I was just going to say, this sounds like stupid young people stuff.
Well, it turns out that those kids were filming a rap music video there.
Okay.
That's why they were hanging out in the parking lot. The kid himself, he's actually a pretty decent kid. Okay, well, here, let me start from the beginning. What happened is that apparently there was an incident where that paletero was already sort of getting into it with those kids.
Uh-huh.
And the kids were just kind of like, there's video where you can hear them say like, oh, let's kick his, you mm-hmm. know,
kick his butt.
Yeah. And then instead they just take his cart and run with it. So it turned into this whole thing.
Well,
where
I would rather have him mess with his cart rather than physically assaulting the man.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel like it was just like this joke that went too far is the way, yes, like a lot of people explain it. And I don't want to, like, dump too much on the paletero, but, like, you know, like, it was sort of like this thing between the both of them. They were both sort of fighting, you know. So they say the paletero started it, such and such, right?
Yep.
The next day, there's a community activist named Walter who found the paletero and found the kid who tipped over the cart, and he brought them together, and apologized. He apologized to the paletero.
Yeah.
And they did pretty well, and everything was okay, it seemed. Vaughn, another activist from the north side, Vaughn Mays. Yeah, good friend, great community organizer. He knows the kid that had tipped over the paletero cart. He said, I know this kid. He was he was in a program with me where I was mentoring him.
Uh-huh.
And he's not a bad kid.
Yes.
So Vaughn got involved, and then I took it upon myself to get involved as well and say, yeah, let's not turn this into a black versus brown thing. And, you know, let's all just kind of try to find a solution, which we did. You know, like, everybody apologized, but all of a sudden everybody had opinions.
Yeah.
You know, the South Side is kind of a funny place that way. Everybody wants to.
Every neighborhood is like that, right? Everybody's got an opinion about what should happen.
Yeah, and everybody's got their solution, and everybody has, like, I thought of this first. No, I thought of this first. No, I thought of this. And it's just, for me, it's just such a headache because it's, my idea was, okay, I had a press conference, and I said, I want to introduce some kind of legislation at the county to protect street vendors, right?
Yeah. That doesn't exist?
No. I mean, in the United States, Los Angeles has, like, this thing where they have, like, a designated area.
Okay.
And they create a designated area for, like, street vendors to come and vend. And that has supposedly been very successful, but there's been nothing like that in the rest of the country.
Even in New York City, because like street vendors are just ubiquitous, right? In New York City and a lot of neighborhoods in Chicago, whether you're talking about like the Chicago style hot dog, my favorite kind of hot dog, right? Or they're just everywhere. I can't believe there's not some kind of model set of protections. I know they do that for food trucks. You know, like here's the designated area. Here's how we're licensing them. But beyond, I guess, the licensure, it's what are the protections for those kinds of vendors? What do they have in LA?
I mean, they have a designated area for street vendors specifically. That's about it. You know what I mean? Which is already kind of like something like that already kind of exists, but it's for food trucks, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. The thing is that a lot of times street vendors are undocumented people. They are afraid to go to the police if they get assaulted, but there have been a lot of assaults on street vendors. There was a few years ago, Don Emilio Garza, his name was, he was a corn vendor. He was shot and he died.
Here in Milwaukee?
Here in Milwaukee, yeah. Wow. And it was actually over by my dad's house by Kosciuszko Park. Some community activists got together, raised some money, and were able to pay for his funeral. And, you know, there was a big outcry against how there's nothing in place for street vendors. So like me and Supervisor Caroline Gomez, Tom and Joe Casta and Jose Perez said, we need to figure something out, right? The carts are permitted and the people are going to be permitted as well. I mean, they do have their permits, but some of them don't.
Yeah.
But creating like a space for them to go to we're trying to follow that Los Angeles model, I guess.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Trying to figure something out so they're not afraid to call the police. Some community activists also established a hotline.
This is a problem with in every single immigrant community everywhere in the world. People who are immigrants, whether they have come here legally or not, but especially if they haven't come through the appropriate process, are often terrified of interacting with law enforcement, and it makes those folks especially vulnerable to abuse, violent crime, etc. We certainly know that we're seeing that in and around migrant workers that work in and that are essential to Wisconsin's farming industry. We know that has happened. We know it's happened in really extraordinarily abusive ways in Florida and California. That history is there. Including sexual assaults, non-payment of wages, all kinds of, you know, horrifying working and living conditions. This is a particular sort of subset of persons that are vulnerable. Where are you in the legislative process, Juan?
Well, with that, I mean, we have to work with Parks. I mean, because we spoke with Parks and Parks had said, making a designated area, because, you know, Parks is where we would do something like that. The city is a lot better at, you know, establishing an area like that. Me and Caroline thought Parks right away. Parks had told us if there's not a special event going on, there's no reason to have, like, special sectioned off areas for street vendors, right? And that does make sense, right? I mean, you know, the parks are not, like, constantly full of people where they're going to be able to make some money throughout the day. But Joe Casta is, she had worked on some food truck stuff, and I think that she wanted to continue with that. But as far with that, well, that's the legislation that we still have to like sort of figure out with Parks, me and Caroline. My thing was to prevent violence like this is I wanted to create a county-sponsored Cinco de Mayo festival in Mitchell Park.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That deals with that particular event. One of our regular listeners and callers just messaged in a question, and it's not meant to be in any way stated, but in goodwill, because I've heard people ask this question. If people are here illegally, why should we expend taxpayer dollars or law enforcement dollars to help protect them? And we'll get into that. I think we've got a little bit of time. My immediate answer, and I'd love to get your impression too, Juan, is that I'll explain it from sort of a conservative lens. And the first conservative lens is people that are here illegally in our country are absolutely essential to every single economy. And in the state of Wisconsin, they are essential to our agricultural industry. If we removed and deported every single person that was here illegally, food prices would skyrocket and our economy, many, many industries would basically shut down. If you work in an office building, I guarantee you a significant portion of the folks that come in and do maintenance, engineering, and other building support, including cleaning services, are undocumented individuals. There, people just, when they trumpet out or trot out these simple notions, just don't realize how absolutely dependent our every single industry at some level is on folks, the labor that is provided, again, often undercutting minimum wage laws, all sorts of things that props up the entire United States economy. You get into chambers of commerce and they're not trumpeting the same race baiting, xenophobic hate speech because they know immigrants and migrant workers are essential to our economies and their business owners that belong to the chambers of commerce tell them so. Mm-hmm. On a secondary level, forgetting the sort of what I would call conservative vantage point on it's good for our economy is simply we don't mete out law enforcement protections that give each of us the right, the human dignity right to walk through the world unmolested and unharmed. We don't meet these things out based upon an individual's characteristics. We don't give, we shouldn't be, at least that's the ideal. Men don't get more of it than women. Black folks don't get more of it than white folks. That's the ideal. That your individual demographic characteristics do not result in different treatment, including protections under the law. That's a fundamental value of our country. I'm going to come back with Milwaukee County Board Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My guest this half hour is Milwaukee County Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. We're talking about the Mitchell Park neighborhood in Milwaukee, but it begat a larger conversation about how, you know, politicized and I think polarized undocumented people have become in this country and so vilified. And you wanted to make an important point. One of our regular listeners and callers texted in and said, I've heard from people, why should taxpayer dollars be used, whether it's through policing or other safety net systems, for undocumented people? And we were I mentioned that undocumented workers are an essential piece of nearly every industry. They help prop up every single economy, regional, local, et cetera. And that we here in the United States, we're founded on a principle of people are treated equally under the law. You had a couple of other really important points, Juan.
Taxpayer dollars do come from undocumented people as well.
They're paying a lot of taxes.
Yeah, undocumented people pay a lot of taxes. And contrary to popular belief, I know this is a major right-wing talking point, but we're here to dispel that undocumented people cannot qualify for food assistance or for benefits that they call like welfare or whatever. They can't qualify for anything like that, and they do pay penny of tax. So it's not our taxpayer dollars, it's their taxpayer dollars as well.
Yes.
There is a big argument, right, about that the undocumented labor drives down the price of labor, right, in general,
or drives wages down.
Yes. And what it is that without a clear pathway to citizenship, without some kind of program to issue work permits, that's going to continue. I mean, these are problems that can be solved. These are problems that can be solved by doing things like that. And it's not special privileges or anything like that, because these people are fighting every day. Like you were saying, I've never met an undocumented person that says, I want to stay undocumented. You know what I mean?
Right.
People want to be a part of all of this. You know what I mean? It's just,
yes,
it makes absolutely no sense that we would lock people out and we would say, you're not allowed to do this. And it also like really bugs me too, that a person's worth, specifically undocumented people, is measured in what they contribute to the economy. Right.
Yeah.
It's,
and I didn't mean to
no,
suggest
I know you
that.
Didn't.
It's
no.
just when engaging with a conservative, that's one of the,
yeah,
it's a place that you can sometimes gain some traction.
Yeah. I mean, this is, and I mean, I hesitate to go to that whole argument about this is a nation of immigrants, but it really is. You know what
yes.
I mean? And it's,
unless you're a First Nation person,
yeah,
it's kind of like, guess what? When you're Irish, German, Italian,
mm-hmm,
Swedish, Norwegian, what have you, ancestor,
yeah,
got here, they were probably getting paid less,
yeah,
than other workers.
Exactly. So, you know, it's, there's no reason to, you know, say like, oh, why should we do this for them? And it's just sort of like, well, it's all of us together. You know, they're
well, I
they're
think
also,
that,
yeah.
Yeah. I struggle with this all the time, right? So when we're talking about what works for the middle class and mm-hmm what works for workers in this country, the narrative becomes, or has been proposed and then pounded by the right, that there's an us and a them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, it's just us and more of us.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like this is the point. And so if we want to see robust wage growth, if we want to see wages and hourly wage-based jobs that actually can support a family like they used to 40 to 50 years ago, a pathway to citizenship or a pathway to getting legally recognized is part of how you do that, because then industries can't abuse undocumented folks.
Exactly.
No, I don't know what an undocumented person is, we were talking about, that wants to remain undocumented, that wants to remain locked out of systems, that wants to pay tax and receive relative to other working wage earners less benefits in the long term, that wants to remain vulnerable, that wants to be paid less than a minimum wage.
Yeah.
Right? This is about people when people are vulnerable and they cannot access a legal system, or they are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a system of incredible leverage, and it creates all of the preconditions for abuse. So if you want to see higher wages, if you think undocumented people drive down wages and you're upset about that, the thing to do is be asking your elected officials, what is the pathway to citizenship? How mm-hmm do we get these people back effectively into the system?
Yeah.
They're paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, I think in a lot of our industries, and listen, agriculture included, and I'm not talking about small family farms, I'm talking about massive agribusiness, the way that certain government subsidies get meted out, there's a whole gamut of incentive systems that we could use mm-hmm to help ensure that working conditions and wages are fair across the board.
100%. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about like border control and stuff like that, or like, oh, policing the borders or controlling the border. Now, if that's going to happen, then make it work for immigrants. And the way you do that is to make sure that people aren't being exploited. So border patrol or border control would have that benefit.
Yes.
If it's done properly, to make sure that workers aren't being exploited.
Yes.
Instead of this whole thing. And I think like people can get behind
Can I just emphasize this? It's like, we can do these things together. These are not ors. It mm-hmm is ands. Like, yes, we need additional resources at the border, but you can't do that and not increase the capacity of the immigration system, mm-hmm, more immigration judges, more of the investigators that help when people are making claims of asylum. We need to get the process working again.
Mm-hmm.
This will have these added benefits of helping to actually support and drive up wages to mm-hmm avoid exploitation of people. It's critical. I have never heard a single liberal say, I want an open border.
No. And the thing is that it's just not possible. I mean,
no,
it's just not something that's going to happen. And I feel like you can do that, but just make it work for the people that are coming across it, and you know, that are coming across. And it's just very, very important, instead of conflating all these like things that, oh, this undocumented immigrant gone drunk and hit somebody. Like, that's the main talking point, instead of, you know, of what undocumented immigrants are actually doing for the country.
Yes.
And I forgot what the point was I was going to make there, but yeah.
Can you hang out for a little bit more?
Sure, sure.
Sure. We'll bring back, we'll talk more about this. I mean, this is the interesting and the hard stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's how do we facilitate these conversations and actually have an intelligent dialogue about all of these problems. As I like to say, all the easy problems have been solved. The only stuff left is the tough stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where we're actually talking about commonly held values and trying to balance those as we move forward. I'm Maggie Dawn. My guest this hour now, moving into the second half of the hour, is County Board Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. You have a question or comment, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Don't go anywhere. Your farm update is next. And then I'll be back with Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. Yeah.
We're building a wall in Colorado.
I got my driver's license last week, just like we always talked about. 'Cause you were so excited for me to finally drive up to your house.
What's up, Wisconsin? Welcome back. I'm Maggie Dawn. My guest this hour is Milwaukee County Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. We've been talking about immigration and all the complexities of this issue, and the fact that, you know, we need to be able to actually talk about complicated things in a way where everybody doesn't lose their marbles, you don't start swearing at one another, and we're actually digging in on the policy. You shared with me an anecdote, I believe it was your aunt, how long it took her to get her citizenship. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there's my tia Carmen. So my dad has 13 brothers and sisters. They all came at separate times, starting in the 70s. My dad came here in 1973. My aunt was one of the last ones to come. She came in 1993, and she applied for citizenship around 1993, close to 94. And when I was doing doors recently, I had an opponent that said, quote, illegals are not constituents. And he was giving out Border Patrol merit badges. And it just baffled me that he would say that in a district that has 73% Latino population, most of them undocumented. So I went and spoke to my aunt. I had a lengthy discussion with her about citizenship and the way she said she applied in 94 and she didn't get it till about 2011.
I mean, check that, right? Like. Yeah. That is 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
Am I doing that math correctly, Brian? Is 1994 to 2011?
17.
Okay.
17 years.
Doing math on the radio is never, I'm a freaking economist and I'm going to do basic addition and subtraction wrong. I did some pro bono work for a couple of people that applied for asylum when I was working in New York. One of the cases I had been working on for like 3.5 years, it was still going when I left the firm. Mm-hmm. The other case I worked on, I think for like 5 years, and it was just, I had to hand over like the last and final, like the merits hearing was in 3 or 4 parts and there was one part left and another lawyer, and they both ended up getting asylum, but it was like years and years and years. And I said this off air, and you said you need to say that on the air. I'll just say this. There are lots of very good immigration lawyers out there, but I will say this. The immigration bar amongst lawyers is, for all the reasons we've been talking about this hour, it puts lawyers in a position where they can abuse the heck out of their clients.
Mm-hmm.
People are afraid. They may not speak the language. They certainly hold no currency. I'm sorry. I'm not going to quote Paul Simon right now. The people don't speak the language. They don't know how to navigate the system. a lot of immigration lawyers will ask for absolutely astronomical retainers from their clients. The client has no idea how they'd get the retainer back, right? If they wanted to fire the lawyer, they don't know that they're entitled to that.
Yeah.
If the retainer has not been used. And it's like, well, I'm going to hire this lawyer for $10,000 or I'm going to get deported. What am I going to do? It's just, again, those power asymmetries. And I have watched some of the worst lawyering I have ever seen in immigration court. Bad lawyering.
Yeah.
And I just think, oh my gosh, this is horrifying.
And you know, like nonprofits that spring up are direct results of those bad lawyerings, right? I mean, you got groups like Voces de la Frontera who are out here trying to help undocumented people navigate those immigration law systems, you know?
And one thing, I mean, if folks are listening out there, and particularly conservative listeners, I'll say to you this. Hey, are you of Social Security age? Are you a veteran? Have you tried to navigate a government system mm-hmm. for benefits that you have earned, or any government system? We're so bad at streamlining things here. It's like, well, you got to fill this form out in triplicate, and then you got to do it again for this other department over there. It's really confusing. And I think that's one of the greatest obstacles for so many people, whether we're talking about older folks trying to get the benefits they've earned, veterans trying to get the benefits they've earned, or an undocumented person that's trying to get documented and become a citizen. We've made it infinitely complicated and really expensive and very scary, with dire consequences if you don't get it right.
Yeah, 100%. And I don't want to, you know, engage in conspiracy theories, because in the end, it's a conspiracy theory to say that, like, you know, but you know what? It's not. It's keeping immigrants down. I mean, it's a major like power play, like on the part of like you know, Republicans or even Democrats sometimes, to make it so difficult for them to like navigate that system to get their citizenship and to be able to partake in the same kind of freedoms that we do as
well. And there's that's what's lurking behind the driver's license debate,
yeah.
Right? It's like, well, they have no right to drive. Well, guess what? Immigrants are driving cars because they have to participate in the economy, to fill the jobs that, generally speaking, white working class people don't want to do in the first place. And they've got to get around. So they're going to drive cars, and they're either going to do that with a license or without one. So maybe you get a license and then people have insurance and it works better.
You know, and the thing is, I have people that I know, people in the police force, who have said there's nothing they would love more than to be able to have undocumented people have licenses.
Yes.
Because
business
they say
owners.
It makes them, yes. It makes it so much easier for police too, you know, because like, you
it's
know,
an identification card.
Yeah. And like, the thing is that they say, and I said, why doesn't the police union step forward? Well, like they say that, well, they're apolitical, right? They do not have like, that's the whole argument as to why like those police unions won't step forward and support undocumented or licenses for all, you know, which is really upsetting, because it would help so much if they were able to get their licenses, and if the help of like something like the police union, I mean, like, that's not something I like back or anything, you know, but if the police unions come forward and say that,
it's when you talk to law enforcement, the message is really clear. If that person that you're talking to is being really candid, it's, we want undocumented people that will talk to us. We need undocumented people to talk to us. We mm-hmm. don't want people to be afraid. We, the local police, are not, we don't work for ICE. And yep, it would be safer. Every community would be safer if undocumented persons had driver's license,
mm-hmm.
because it is identification.
You get insurance.
You get insurance, all of these things. Mm-hmm. This is one of those moments where I go, hey, if you know, you need to say. Don't hide behind the very political. Well, be issue advocates about what promotes public safety, because that is your job, mm-hmm. and come out and say it if you know it.
Yeah.
This has been a really fascinating conversation, yeah. Juan. Will you come back sometime and we'll continue?
Of course. Anytime. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Maggie.
Same, my friend. That's my guest. Juan Miguel Martinez joined us. He's a Milwaukee County Board Supervisor. Thanks for your time this afternoon, Juan.
Thank you.
Promised everybody we were going to talk about the gutless GOP, Brian. Do you think they're ready?
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
I don't know that anyone is ready for this, but let's do it.
So one of the things that I talk about frequently is sort of what I define as performative politicians. And performative politicians are those that take a position, take a stance, maybe even endorse a candidate, Not because it's the right thing to do, but because it's going to get them more famous, more money, more power, because it allows them to simply exercise privilege and power in a way that doing the right thing probably wouldn't. That's performative politics. And I am so thoroughly disgusted beyond any measure by the vast majority of traditional conservative politicians who for years bash Donald Trump, talk about how completely unfit he is to be president, and have now endorsed the man or said publicly that they're going to vote for him. It's ridiculous. And the most recent flip-flopper, the most recent varsity team member of the gutless GOP is former presidential candidate, former UN ambassador Nikki Haley. Let's take a listen to some of Nikki Haley telling us all how terrible the former MAGA president is.
I don't believe Donald Trump can beat Joe Biden. Nearly every day, Trump drives people away. This is not the time to play footsie with dictators. You don't need someone like Donald Trump, who 2 weeks ago said that he would encourage Putin to invade our allies. Donald Trump told Congress not to do anything until after the general election because it would hurt him. We can't wait one more day to pass a strong border bill.
Maybe a little bit about the debt. Perhaps there's a little Nikki Haley talking about Donald Trump and the debt.
What did Donald Trump do? $8 trillion in debt in just 4 years, more than any other president.
Yeah, and is America winning or losing Nikki Haley because of Donald Trump?
At some point, maybe we should say the reason that America keeps losing is because of Donald Trump.
Well, thank you, Nikki. This is all very clarifying. But what's that you say?
I put my priorities on a president who's going to have the backs of our allies and hold our enemies to account, who would secure the border, no more excuses. A president who would support capitalism and freedom.
I feel like that's, let's hear, she's got to say some more, I think.
Yeah, there might be more.
Trump has not been perfect on these policies. I've made that clear many, many times.
Many times.
But Biden has been a catastrophe. So I will be voting for Trump.
I love that the given is that he's a catastrophe with no proof, no, like, this is what he did and that's why it's a catastrophe. It's just, he's a catastrophe. Why? Because he's a catastrophe.
Well, because ask Gary from Sussex, because he feels that way.
Whatever it is, your feelings are totally facts.
Hey, the woman for months on the campaign trail was nothing if not very specific about how completely dangerous Donald Trump is to this country, to our allies, to this economy, to our border. And then magically one day she's like, you know, for our border, our allies, our democracy, our economy, the man for the job is Donald Trump. How do these words come out of your mouth without her turning into like a pumpkin? I don't get it.
Would you go into business with him? No. Would you go to church with him? No. Would you leave him alone with your wife or daughter? No.
No. Who are you voting for? That guy.
That guy. Why? Because he's not a Democrat. That's it.
Yes. This is fundamentally the question that I keep getting to every time I engage with conservatives. Is it only and ever about winning?
Yes.
Basically. Not basically. Yes, period. It's a full sentence.
You can tell because of the backflips people do when proven wrong just to sound like they were right in their minds when they were making the decision so that they wouldn't ever possibly think or feel that they might have been wrong and or possibly dumb.
Listen, I've said dumb things. I've done dumb things.
I've been called out for saying stupid racist things that I had no idea I was doing. And you know what's great?
You'll learn from it.
Saying, yep, that was right. You're right. I said something dumb. And you know what's great? We moved on. And then everyone was cool after that. because it wasn't a huge discussion. Nobody cried. I felt a little dumb for a minute, and then I said, yeah, that was pretty bad. I moved on.
And I have repeatedly talked about and interviewed politicians that have admitted that they made a mistake, that their minds have been changed, that they've moved on. They have a different policy position than they did when they started, or maybe even 2 weeks ago. And I admire that. What I don't admire is people who say this wasn't a debate over the fineries of tax policy. We'll get to that next week. This was a question about the fitness of a particular person to lead, frankly, the free world. And absolute, unequivocal personal indictments of that individual's complete unfitness to lead the free world, said repeatedly over months, repudiated and washed away with one magic wand, and morphed all of a sudden into winning's more important than having people with morals and values that match American morals and values leading our country and the free world. I mean, for real. And apparently there is a verdict breaking in the Donald Trump hush money trial. We're going to take a couple of messages. Do not go anywhere. I'm going to go try to see what the verdict is. I'm going to break that news here on the Civic Media Radio Network, and I might even slam a couple of other gutless GOP flip-floppers. My name's Maggie Dawn. I got Brown and Kelly in the booth. You want to join us, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Back in just a moment.
I'm Satan reincarnated.
We have breaking news here on the Civic Media Radio Network. According to the New York Times and other sources, including MSNBC, about 13 minutes ago, Judge Juan Merchan, presiding over the former MAGA president's voter manipulation trial in New York State Court in Lower Manhattan, received a note from the jury foreperson at 4:20 this afternoon. No weed jokes, Brian. At 4:20 this afternoon, East Coast time, saying that the jury has reached a verdict. They requested 30 minutes to fill out the jury forms. Eyewitness accounts in the courtroom said that as soon as the judge announced that a verdict had been reached, the former MAGA president's demeanor changed immediately. He had been smiling and sort of engaging with his counsel, Todd Blanche, seated next to him. And that he became very serious, stopped talking immediately, crossed his arms over his chest, is now whispering with his lawyers. So court prognosticators, when did the case went to the jury? What is it? It's Thursday. I think it was given to the jury on Tuesday. This is a pretty quick turnaround on what is, in all respects, a fairly complicated business fraud case. When you see quick verdicts, in general, it is the legal wisdom that likely indicates that the jury reached a prosecution-friendly verdict. In other words, they got in there, yep, the evidence meets the standard, and out you go. This case, of course, not like any other case in history. We have a former president on trial for crimes, specifically crimes that related to the election in 2016. And I didn't get into this today, but I will mention this simply because it's extraordinary. What happened over the last day was Donald Trump and some of his allies in the media pushed out a narrative that Judge Merchan had instructed the jurors that they could individually choose from these 34 different charges to find the former president guilty, like choose your own adventure. Just check which boxes you think. And as long as they somehow got to 12 votes, that would be enough to convict him. That's untrue. And anybody who spent 5 minutes watching, I don't know, Perry Mason, Law and Order, bust in legal. I mean, pick your legal drama.
All I need is 12 votes. I'm looking for 12 votes. Am I on
in other words,
phone being recorded saying this?
Yeah, I'm on 12 votes. In other words, so there's 34. If just 12 of them checked guilty on any one of the 34, that would count. No. You have to reach unanimity. All 12 jurors on each charge separately, each charge taken separately in order to reach a guilty verdict. This, you won't be surprised here. The suggestion was made in an online post by Fox News anchor John Roberts, and then immediately had like 5.7 million views. I mean, this is up there with Marjorie Taylor Greene claiming that Joe Biden was trying to assassinate Donald Trump when the DOJ executed a search warrant at his property at Mar-a-Lago after Donald Trump, not once, not twice, not three times, not after a subpoena, not after an extra subpoena, making sure that he got the first subpoena, not after his lawyer told him, you better turn over all the nation's secret classified super duper confidential spy materials. You got to turn those back over to the government. You know, after all that, and the FBI finally had to go in to make sure that he had turned over all the nation's super secret spy materials back to the nation.
Even super excuse maker Bill Barr.
Yeah.
Even super excuse maker Bill Barr was like,
no,
that's really, really bad and wrong. And it's his own fault.
Yeah. That search warrant included language that law enforcement may use deadly force if they themselves or another person's life is in imminent danger. It's stock language. It's in all their search warrants. They freaked out about that one. This one's almost as bad as that. Out of 34, you just need 12 people on any old charge to vote guilty, and that's enough. That's a terrible, terrible bit of misinformation. This was Mr. Roberts writing again on X. Judge Mershon just told the jury that they do not need unanimity to convict. Four could agree on one crime, four on a different one, and the other four on another. He said he would treat 444 as a unanimous verdict.
What?
That's what the guy said.
Okay, so I'm assuming he has a source that he puts in there as a
no.
No.
Why would he do that? Sources aren't important. I'm just a journalist. Oh, wait. Truly, truly shocking. This is amazing to me. Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney, is now in the courtroom as of 2 minutes ago, seated in the audience behind the prosecutors who tried this case for his office. Eric Trump seated behind his father. We expect the judge to bring in the jury any moment now. I would also expect defense counsel Todd Blanche to request the judge after the jury is read to ask the judge to poll the jurors as to each count. So this proceeding will take a while. It is 4 o'clock, nearly 4 o'clock Wisconsin time. It is 5 o'clock New York time. They're going to wrap this up today. No, Donald Trump will not be going to jail this evening. His sentencing will be a separate hearing decided by the judge.
But this guy on Twitter said,
yeah, don't get your news from Twitter. It's dangerous. Well, guess what we're going to have tomorrow, folks? A whole verdict to talk about and dissect. We're also going to have the entire gutless GOP. I wonder if any other gutless GOP varsity team members will be standing by their man. Because remember, I told you yesterday exactly what's going to happen. This is going to be a mixed bag, folks. I don't think you're going to see guilty verdicts across the board. You will see some on some counts. Don't you worry. I'll be back tomorrow to break it all down for you, count by count. 1, 2, 3, 34, 34 counts. I'm Maggie Dawn. He is Brian Kelly. You've been listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together. Go crew!
I'm so surprised. And so does Mershon, loathes me. The judge. hates Donald Trump. Just take a look. Take a look at him. Take a look at where he comes from.
It's over. Nothing matters anymore.